It's time now for our ongoing series discussing substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium. And we have a couple of people with us today.
My name is Dr. Andrea Civerini. I'm a addiction medicine provider. I practice primarily in Vancouver, but I also work with our program in Aberdeen.
I'm Sherwin Phillips, and I'm with Lifeline Connections, and I'm a care navigator.
And I'm Elizabeth Lorenzo, and I am with Lifeline Connections in the Aberdeen office. I am the administrative supervisor and also a substance use professional counselor.
Okay, we're all here to talk about substance use, and it is a treatable disease. Let's just start with that, folks. Whoever wants to talk first, substance abuse is treatable, correct?
Absolutely treatable. It is a disorder of the brain. It is co-occurring with mental health often. And a lot of people believe that it is a choice. I was one of those people that believed it was a choice, addiction in general, but it is not.
And we will get to that choice thing a little bit later on.
Okay.
Yeah. I do want to talk about, just this last week was the anniversary of Kurt Cobain's death. Obviously, a substance abuse problem with Mr. Cobain. And that was 25 years ago, believe it or not.
Right.
Treatment for substance abuse has improved greatly in that time. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, what kind of things have changed since Kurt Cobain's death to now?
So I can speak to some of that. One of the things that has made a big difference in availability to evidence-based treatments, which include medication-assisted treatment, is that Congress passed a law in 2000 called the DATA law. And what that did was it shifted the laws or rules regarding providing medication to patients for opioid use disorders, which, as we call it, which includes heroin and also commonly abused prescription pills. And traditionally, prior to that, really, if you wanted medication to help treat your opioid use disorder, you had to go to a methadone clinic. And methadone is highly regulated by the federal government, and it makes access to care, not as available to a lot of people. So once they passed the DATA law, this allowed any physician with a DEA license to obtain a special waiver so that they could prescribe certain substances that were on a particular category of the controlled substance schedule. And the main thing that includes is buprenorphine, which is commonly called Suboxone, which is one of the brand names. And what that did was it allowed providers to prescribe that medication out of their offices and out of treatment programs without having to dispense it. So it's available through a prescription, and so it became more like you would go to the doctor to get your depression treated and get medication for that, and you would go to the pharmacy with a prescription rather than going to a methadone clinic every single day. So that's really made a big difference in the way that people access care and are able to remain in care, honestly, because they are able to find a care model that is more unique to them rather than having to go to one specific type of place.
More of an outpatient thing and the more distribution opportunities then.
Yes, and also more different models. So not everyone who gets treatment goes to a facility like ours, which is a program specifically for substance use and mental health. I used to practice in Oregon at a primary care and integrative medicine clinic, and I was a private practice doctor, and I practiced and provided Suboxone treatment through our office. And so not everybody is comfortable going to a treatment center or wants to. And so primary care providers and psychiatrists can provide this medication out of their offices to their patients without the patient needing to go enroll in a separate program.
Okay. You mentioned one drug besides methadone you've talked about, and methadone has been around for a long time. Methadone is one form of treatment, but you were mentioning another drug. Are there more drug opportunities in regards to trying to curb the substance use?
So the three FDA-approved medications for opioid use disorder are methadone, buprenorphine, and a medication called naltrexone. Naltrexone is also commonly called Vivitrol because the Vivitrol is the shot version, which is once a month, and it tends to be more effective. So most people who use that as a treatment will kind of refer to it as Vivitrol. They each have their pluses and minuses in terms of effectiveness and to make it simple, the best treatment is the one that's going to work for that patient. So, for some people, methadone is a great option, and for other people, it doesn't work well for them. It's kind of like a lot of things. It's nice to have those options so that a patient can choose what they think is going to work well for them, or if one thing isn't effective, then they have other options to try.
Now, if a person is abusing substances, and we'll just take heroin as an example here, with someone using heroin and then they go into a treatment program like this and get one of these prescription drugs to take to try to help them, I remember something for alcoholics years ago, and I don't even know if it's still around. I think they called it ad abuse or something. But if you took it, you drank the alcohol and you got violently sick. Are these sort of working that way in regards to substance abuse?
That's a good question. So you're right. Ad abuse, it's actually still available. We really don't use it very much. We have other medications we use for alcohol use disorder. In fact, naltrexone or Vivitrol has been shown to be a very effective medication for alcohol use disorder. With opioid medication assisted treatment, you can get sick, particularly with buprenorphine, if you stop taking it and then you use an opioid and then you start taking it again too quickly. But in general, if you have those medications sort of in your system and then you use on top of them, it doesn't generally make you ill. But with buprenorphine and naltrexone, there's a blocking mechanism that prevents you from a person from feeling the high that they would get from using the substance. So that's not true for methadone. Methadone is an opioid itself. And so if people use on top of opioids, on top of methadone, then they're increasing their likelihood of an overdose, which is why methadone is so tightly regulated, because it is a more risky thing if you're using at the same time. But the other two medications do have a blocking effect that is helps people genuinely, like if they have like what I call a slip, and they use, a lot of times they'll say, gosh, I got tempted, I was in a bad situation, I felt like I needed to use, but I didn't feel anything. It's interesting when they say that, because then there's kind of this test. They say, oh, it was kind of interesting to have that experience and realize that that's true.
So the high they're looking for, they don't get.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move along to something else here. A lot of people believe that addiction is a moral failing or something to overcome with willpower. And you talked about that earlier, that you used to think that.
I did. I absolutely believe that addiction was, especially to drugs, was a choice. My personal addiction is food.
Uh-huh.
And so I justified my belief in that food was something that was necessary in order to live, but drugs was not. So in the process of learning about addiction, I found that it may start out as a choice with some people, but it's a choice to feel better or to overcome something that's going on in the brain. So my background is long-term care and physical health. 40-some years of that. That's where I gain my experience from, is I look at people who suffer, say, like from diabetes and diabetic complications. They know full well that their diet is what helps them control their blood sugars. But do they necessarily do everything that they need to do to have the best outcome? No, it's just something that we do. Addiction to drugs and alcohol, I find, are very similar with people. Some people need the medication assistance to help them get to the point to where they can actually process their thoughts and their feelings around why they go to that drug. So I firmly now believe that addiction is a disease of the brain. It's how we think. And we do whatever we can to make ourselves feel better. So a diabetic may need medication assistance through a pill or even insulin injections, much like an addict may need some kind of medication to help them learn how to regulate what their body needs. We don't think clearly unless our mind is clear. And all we do in addiction is to comfort ourselves and make ourselves feel better, which is all mental and emotional.
And it could be an underlying problem that gets you to that point.
Exactly.
Where you take that first shot of heroin or that first OxyContin or that first bite of chocolate cake.
Exactly. So when I see a lot of clients who come in that were kids that were introduced to opioids during school years by their primary care physician for pain management after something that happened in an accident, an automobile accident or a sports-related accident, and now they're addicted. So they can no longer get the prescription from their primary care doctor, so they go to the streets and on to opioids and heroin and other drugs. So they need to learn how to, because as juveniles, their brain isn't fully developed. And there's scientific proof to back that up. Until around the age of 27, your frontal lobe in your brain is just not developed enough. So why do we have addiction? It's because we learn how to stay in that from a very young age. And then as we grow older, we don't implement changes in our behaviors. So that's where the two of a prescription and treatment to understand why we think and feel and believe the way that we do. And everybody has their individual journey. So recognizing your own beliefs and thoughts about where you're at. I love being in a group setting with my clients and have them go, oh, that's why that's that way. So I strongly believe the connection between treatment and getting rid of the stigma that we have of people walking in to a treatment center for mental health or substance use. We need to glorify the fact that we're getting treatment for that and make hospitals and treatment centers recognizable.
Okay, I took OxyContin because I was in pain. I'm just saying that. I really haven't. I don't think I've ever had an OxyContin in my life because I've been very fortunate. I haven't been in any bad accidents or anything like that, or no major pain. But to people who are taking it, it makes them feel good. It makes them feel right. I've even heard it said, it makes me feel normal.
Hmm. Yes. So, I'd like to speak to that, if that's okay.
Yeah.
So we've to add to what Elizabeth was saying, and I will address that point. We have so much research in the area of neuroscience or brain science in the, I mean, if you want to say the last 25 years since Kurt Cobain died, that shows us the pathways that the reward pathways and the brain chemicals that are involved in addiction, and they're the same ones no matter what you're addicted to, no matter whether it's gambling or food or online shopping. Even there's some really growing data, research data on technology addictions, so like gaming. And so we do have the brain science research to back it up. And the other, and the second piece of that, there's three, genetics plays a huge role. And then the other piece is what we refer to as ACEs, or adverse childhood events. And we know that childhood trauma is a major contributor to substance use later in life. So part of the work I do, my background is in OBGYN, and then I became board certified in addiction medicine as a subspecialty. One of the things that I do is work with pregnant women and women with young children to try to break the cycle, so that there's the trauma, to minimize the trauma on the next generation, because they may have the genetics, but you can overcome the genetics with the right types of healthy environments and good parenting. And then the last piece, to address your question about the oxycodone, so not everybody feels good when they take these medications, and that's where the genetic differences come in. So I talk to my patients about this all the time, and Elizabeth was right. A lot of these folks, they started out, you know, having surgeries or accidents, or maybe they were just in high school and a lot of them have anxiety disorders, untreated mental health disorders. And so somebody says, hey, try this pill, it'll make you feel better. And what happens is some people take them and they go, that doesn't feel good. I don't like it. It makes me feel funny, or it makes me nauseated. And some people take it and they say, well, that made my pain better. That was great, but it didn't make me feel, you know, what we call euphoric or euphoria. Hmm. And then other people take it and they say, hey, I really like this stuff.
Yeah, where's this been all my life, you know?
Yeah, and so that's been, that's one of the ways that we have addressed the opioid crisis in this country, which I think has been pretty effective, has been to address the prescribing of opiates by physicians and mid-level practitioners. And because there was such a push, I mean, I was in the generation in medical school where we said, you know, pain was the fifth vital sign, and if you didn't treat somebody's pain, you were a bad doctor. So it was very, very pushed, and it was marketed. You know, everyone's heard about the family that, you know, owned or Purdue Pharmaceuticals, and how they've been sued for pushing OxyContin and oxycodone and things like that. So we have addressed that in a very big way, in terms of, and I think, decreasing the number of people that will get introduced to opioids in that way, which is fortunate. But we still have a lot of work to do on the street level, because as Elizabeth was saying, once people become dependent on this medication, it kind of sneaks up on them, and then they get sick if they try to stop it, and they can't afford it anymore. And what's actually way more affordable is heroin, and that's been the case in on the West Coast for decades. It's very affordable, and so people switch to it because that's what they're able to get. And at that point, people they're not having fun with it. They're just, if they don't take it, they're sick. So they it's literally something that they do just to maintain themselves. And unfortunately, unlike things like tobacco or, you know, food or things like that, it doesn't, because of the different health effects it has in terms of, you know, causing infections and issues with, you know, needles, and there's all kinds of problems that it causes. So it's a more visible addiction as being more of a life destroyer, is sort of what I refer to it as. So, yes, there's so many addictions that people have in our country, but the unique thing about opioids and also methamphetamines, which we haven't said, but is that they do wreak havoc on people's lives. And that's why treatment is so important, because it really does allow people to get their lives back and become functioning members of society, which is really all they want to do.
Join us next Monday morning at 8:40 a.m. for our continuing discussion on substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium, exclusively on 103.5 FM and 1450 a.m. KBKW. To hear archived discussions, log on to gograysharbor.com.